measure of hair loss looks very promising in this study and shows that baldness may soon be optional, said Michelle Green of Lenox Hill Hospital in New York City. Let me drop her a set. There have been numerous research efforts into regenerating hair, but this study shows that the dermal sheath can preserve the hair follicle to regenerate new hair growth, she said. Besides potentially arresting the hair growth cycle before its destruction phase, tweaking the dermal sheath might also prevent the hair follicle from going dormant, she reasoned. That's important because dormant hair follicles cannot be restored, therefore they cannot regenerate their hair. Still, a cure for balding plates, pates isn't around the corner, Rendell stressed. There's a longer way to go, realistically, before blocking contraction of the sheath muscle can be made a reality to halt the hair cycle in the destruction phase, he said. It needs to be proven effective in human hair follicles in the dish first, proven safe after knowing what happens to the arrested follicle long term. Still, he said, we are excited about exploring this. Let me drop any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next. Michelangelo's David is perhaps the world's famous statue, most famous statue, gazed upon by millions over the centuries. And yet, it's only this year that an American doctor has spotted an anatomical insight made by the artist, one that passed without notice on David for more than 500 years. In the vast majority of sculptures and in the everyday physiology of living people, the jugular vein running from the upper torso through the neck is not visible. But in the Renaissance masterpiece, the vessel is clearly distended and made visible above David's collarbone, as would occur in any healthy young man who's at a pitch of excitement about facing a potential lethal opponent, in this particular case, Goliath. Jugular vein distension can also occur with illness such as elevated intracardiac pressures and possible cardiac dysfunction, noted Dr. Daniel Geltman, who viewed David in Florence Academia Gallery this year. But David is young and in the peak of physical condition. Only in another context, a state of temporary excitation, does the jugular stand out in this way. David's readying for a battle against the giant would, of course, fit that bill. Michelangelo, like some of his artistic contemporaries, had anatomical training, Gelfman wrote in a letter published December 26th in the Journal of American Medical Association's Cardiology. Quote, I realize that Michelangelo must have noticed temporary jugular venous distension in healthy individuals who are excited. Let me drop for a sec. What's impressive is that this observation came to the artist more than a century before its discovery and documentation by medical science, according to Gelfman. At the time that David was created in 1504, William Harvey had yet to describe the true mechanisms of the circulatory system. This didn't occur until 1628, Gelfman noted. But Michelangelo's power of observation were keen enough to have spotted changes in the vein's behavior on his own. In fact, this anatomical detail appears again in the sculpture of Moses at the tomb of Pope Julius II in Rome. In that artwork, most viewers would also agree that the sitting Moses is thought to be in an excited state, Gelfman wrote. In contrast, the jugular vein of the recently deceased Jesus lying on his mother's lap in Michelangelo's Pietà is not distended or visible, again, anatomically correct in that context. In sculpture, one can only show a single image in time, Gelfman said, and in the case of the excited, frightened David or the agitated Moses, Michelangelo must have wanted to express this circulatory observation in his work. Let me drop for a sec. Quote, I am amazed at his ability to recognize this finding and express it in the artwork at the time when there was such limited information in cardiovascular physiology, Gelfman wrote. Interestingly, even today, this phenomena is not discussed in typical cardiology textbooks. To his knowledge, Gelfman's casual observation during his visit to Florence is the first time Michelangelo's depiction of the distended jugular has been noted in the medical literature, even though it's been hiding in plain sight for over 500 years. Two cardiologists who read Gelfman's report said that the findings also highlight the diagnostic power of simply looking at patients. Quote, It's incredible where a 500-year-old statue can depict physical findings that might be used in diagnosis, said Marcin Kowalski, who directs cardiac electrophysiology at Staten Island University Hospital in New York City. In today's era of high-tech scans and blood tests, he said, it always amazes me where students of anatomy or medicine were able to diagnose diseases by mere observation. For that reason, he said, I hope that the art of physical examination does not disappear from the repertoire of our young physicians and medical schools continue to teach physical findings ahead of high-tech tests, Kowalski said. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on with the next. A team of researchers at McMaster University have developed a self-cleaning surface that can repel all forms of bacteria, preventing the transfer of antibiotic-resistant superbugs and other dangerous bacteria in settings ranging from hospitals to kitchens. The new plastic surface, a treated form of conventional transparent wrap, can be shrink-wrapped onto door handles, railings, IV stands, and other surfaces, and can be that usually can be magnets for bacteria such as MRSA and C. difficile. The treated material is also ideal for food packaging, where it could stop the accidental transfer of bacteria such as E. coli, Salmonella, and Listeria from raw chicken, meat, and other foods, as described in a paper published by the journal ACS Nano. Inspired by the water-repellent lotus leaf, the new surface works through a combination of nanoscale surface engineering and chemistry. The surface is textured with microscopic wrinkles that exclude all external molecules. A drop of water or blood, for example, simply bounces away when it lands on the surface. The same is true for bacteria. Let me drop for a second. We're structurally tuning that plastic, says one of the researchers, an engineer physicist. This material gives us something that can be applied to all kinds of things. The surface is also treated chemically to further enhance its repellent properties, resulting in a barrier that is flexible, durable, and inexpensive. We can see this technology being used in all kinds of institutional and domestic settings, one of the researchers remarked. As the world confronts the crisis of antimicrobial resistance, we hope it will become an important part of antibacterial toolbox. The researchers tested the material using two of the most troubling forms of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, MRSA and Pseudomonas. The team verified the effectiveness of the surface by capturing electron microscope images showing that virtually no bacteria could transfer to the new surface. The researchers are hoping to work with a commercial partner to develop commercial applications for this new wrap. Let me drop any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Harmful to you, members of humanity. Well, science may have some new things for you to worry about. The international research team led by the University of Saskatchewan environmental toxicologist John Giese is sounding the alarm about liquid crystal monomers, the chemical building blocks of everything from flat-screen TVs to solar panels, and the potential threat they pose to humans and the environment. Quote, these chemicals are semi-liquid and can get into the environment at any time during manufacture and recycling, and they are vaporized during burning. Now, we also know that these chemicals are being released by byproducts just by using them, said Gleasy, Canada research chair in environmental toxicology at the University of Saskatchewan. We don't know yet whether this is a problem, but we do know that people are being exposed and these chemicals have the potential to cause adverse effects, said Giese. In a first-of-its-kind paper published December 9th in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Giese's research team assembled and analyzed the comprehensive list of 362 commonly used liquid crystal monomers gathered from 10 different industries and examined each chemical for its potential toxicity. The team also further tested the toxicity of monomers commonly found in 6 frequently used smartphone models. The researchers found that the specific monomers isolated from the smartphones were potentially hazardous to animals and the environment. In lab testing, the chemicals were found to have properties known to inhibit animals' ability to digest nutrients and to disrupt proper functioning of the gallbladder and the thyroid, similar to dioxins and flame retardants, which are known to cause toxic effects in humans and wildlife. Let me drop for a sec. To understand how common these monomers are, teaching hotel, lab, and electronics repair facility. Nearly half of the 53 samples tested positive for liquid crystal monomers. Quote, ours is the first paper to list all the liquid crystal monomers in use and assess their potential to be released and cause toxic effects, said Easy. We looked at over 300 different chemicals and found that nearly 100 have significant potential to cause toxicity. 90% of the monomers tested had concerning chemical properties. They either accumulate in organisms, resist degradation in the environment, or are easily transported long distance in the atmosphere. Nearly one quarter of the chemicals tested had all three troubling characteristics. Quote, there are currently no standards for quantifying these chemicals and no regulatory standards, said Easy. We are at ground zero. LCD panels are almost exclusively produced in 3 Asian countries, China, Japan, and South Korea. It's estimated that 76 square miles of liquid crystal display are produced every year, enough to cover the entire Caribbean island of Aruba. Let me drop for a sec.
Do you think it's time to go on to space, Paul? Roy?
Okay with me if you want to jump to space report.
Okay, good stuff. What's new in space, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW. And do periodically let the machine drop.
Yeah, I got the hang of it. That's what I saw Roy doing it, so I could copy that. I just wait for everything to disappear and start retransmitting. Come to an end of the year, I usually talk about different flights that have gone up over, when I get to the end of the year. Usually we're ahead of other countries. Flights that they've had, they've launched 34 flights, and we were up to 27, so. The ability for China to not only catch up to us, that passes is actually a possibility unless things start to change in the near future, which I think they will. They don't have anywhere near the amount of manned flights that we have. We've put up hundreds of people over the years, and they've only done 3 or 4. But, you know, they're thinking about it. Let me drop it. Okay, there we go. And now the first two people to go up most likely will be Bob Behnken and Don Hurley from American Soil. And they'll probably be launching on the Dragon crew vehicle. And that will probably be within the first 5 months of this year, this coming year. Because SpaceX has gone through all their tests that they needed to do to prove to NASA that they could do this. They have one more important test coming up, probably within a couple of weeks. And that's where they launch a booster of Falcon 9. Booster from 39A, from of Florida, and they'll have a crew vehicle on top. They'll get up to maximum Q, which is about a minute and a half after launch, and they'll duplicate a failure with the booster and have the capsule separate and come down and land in the Atlantic Ocean with four parachutes. Parachutes have been a problem trying to get those things qualified. And it turns out they run 10 tests in a row now. You know, they take a weight, duplicates the weight of a Crew Dragon vehicle, and they push it out of an airplane at, you know, at 7 miles high, and they test these parachutes, and it turns out 10 times in a row they've successfully landed this test weight. So they got the okay for that, and now they just need this in-flight abort test. Let me drop it. Okay, and this is WS2N. So between them and Boeing, I expect a man launch within 6 months. Boeing has the Starliner, and they apparently had a mostly successful test flight. It was supposed to go to the International Space Station. They didn't make it because of the timer, but all the important things worked out. The test of the new vehicle on top of the Atlas V, which they've never done before, was successful in a return with parachutes and on solid land in New Mexico. First time we've landed a crew vehicle on land. I know China has done it and Russia, but we've never done that. We've taken a shuttle and landed out on a runway, you know, over 100 times, but never a crew capsule type vehicle. And that was very successful. So between Boeing and SpaceX, hopefully that will come to pass. Roy was talking about the launches of the Starlink program with, you know, the thousands of satellites that SpaceX plans on putting up. They do have a launch coming up on the 4th of January, and that'll be the next one. And then every 2 weeks thereafter, they plan on, that's their ultimate goal, is to launch every 2 weeks. So they expect around 24 launches just with the Starlink program alone next year. That doesn't include manned space launches or satellite launches, you know, for other private companies or countries. But 24 satellite, 24 Starlink satellite launches. Each launch would have 60 satellites, and each satellite weighs 500 pounds. So it's going to be going to be really something to see these things go up. They're launching another booster this week, which will be the second time they launched a Falcon 9 booster four times. There's one other booster that's done that, and now this one's going to join that group, and eventually they'll launch them up to 10 times before they refurbish them. So let me drop it. Now, Dr. Roy mailed me an email last week, and it had to do with Georgetta from one of the listeners. She wanted to know more about the dust on the moon, so Roy sent it over to me. Thanks for that, Roy. And, you know, we have information on that topic. She's under the impression it's very dangerous for your lungs, which is very true. Each dust particle on Earth, we have, but we don't think too much of it. You know, you try not to inhale it, but, you know, you do every day. If you look at a light, a light beam coming through the window. You know, you're inhaling that every day. But most of those dust particles have been rounded off, you know, either by the wind, erosion, time. You don't have that on them. Any dust particle has very sharp edges and could easily puncture your lung, get into your system. And so your lungs, they said years ago that I remember hearing that you could take your lung and open it up and it would be as big as a tennis court. Doesn't matter if you inhale this stuff, it can cut right through all those cells and really give you problems. It happened to Schmidt on. He was an astronaut, the only science astronaut that ever went up, you know, in the Apollo program. Harrison Schmidt was his name. He was on Apollo 17, and when he got into the lunar module, he got a whiff of this stuff, and he had some tough breathing for a 24-hour period after that. So now what happened was they looked into trying to solve this problem. They know eventually they're going to go back to the moon. What are we going to do about this? Because they studied the size of the dust and how it could cut into your system, into your lungs. You know, there's no way to avoid that. You just can't have a filter on your mouth, and that's not going to be good enough. They need to stop this stuff from getting into the spacecraft altogether. So NASA came up with a solution. And they've taken a problem seriously for a long time, and it's developing several dust mitigation methods. One promising strategy is to cover the surfaces with electrodynamic dust shield. Let me see if I have it. Okay, that's good. Took a few seconds, but we got it back. Very good. And it's strange, you know, a story like this comes out, and right now, I mean, this week, you have scientists in Maryland in NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center presently studying a lot of samples that were brought back from the six NASA Apollo flights that went to the moon and landed there. Those six flights brought back almost 900 pounds of rock and dust. And, a lot of rocks were given away to different countries and all, but there was hundreds of pounds of this stuff that was taken and frozen and put away, frozen solid. And, you know, back as late as 1972, you know, after the Apollo 17 mission. So you wound up with hundreds of pounds of stuff that nobody will ever touch for 50 years. That was the plan. They knew they had test equipment back then, 50 years ago, to test a lot of the samples that were returned, but they knew that maybe 50 years from now, there's going to be better equipment to analyze this stuff. And sure enough, that's what happened. So the 50 years is up. You have scientists now in Maryland looking into the moon dust and the moon rocks that they brought back. So they're going to be looking for things like formaldehyde or hydrogen cyanide. And why are they going to look for that? Because that's the basis of amino acids. And amino acids have been around like for billions of years. Some people really connect that with life. And they want to know what was left up on the moon and investigate it. But at the same time, they'll be able to, you know, take another look at all this fine dust, you know, as they look at all the samples to try to improve on the ideas that they have for protecting future missions. They plan on putting hundreds or if not thousands of people on the moon. They're going to need a better system. I remember Apollo 11 when Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin came back to the command module. You had Mike Collins flying around all by himself for orbit after orbit around the moon. And Mike Collins said to Armstrong and Aldrin, you're not coming into my vehicle. He felt that this is my vehicle. I'm here by myself. He says, you guys look like pigs. There was stuff all over. The dust was all over. So he made sure that they cleaned up the best they could inside the LEM before they came back into the command module of Columbia. So that's the story on that. Does anybody have any questions or comments for the space portion of this Technet? This is WS2M. Okay. Now, for some reason, the article I read that talked about the space dust, by the way, said that somehow it could actually get into your brain. I'm not sure how it does that. Once it gets into your lungs, it can rip you apart, but maybe it's a secondary effect, but eventually it could actually get up into your head. Medically, I'm not sure what the story was that, but they said your lungs, forget it. They did tests with this stuff, and they covered parts of people's lungs. I guess they were some kind of sample lungs that they must have taken out of people after they died, and they tested the dust, and they said like 90% of the lung would be destroyed by rubbing this moon dust into it, and they got not the actual moon dust. They were using stuff that pretty much replicated it. They were using volcanic ash and some kind of synthetic stuff. That's the story. Any comments?
WB2GXM.
WB2GXM. Yeah, go ahead there. And we're letting the repeater completely drop before we pick it up. Otherwise, we're timing it out until it gets repaired. Back to you.
Roger on the timing out. Thank you, Paul. Isn't there a very thin membrane between the sinuses and the brain through which this dust can get through?
AC2GS. Okay, and very good. Yeah, okay, well, that sounds right. And we're going to pick up Roy. So, yeah, go ahead, Doc. Dr. Roy.
Yeah, hello. It isn't really thin. You have a bony layer. The sinuses are kind of hollowed out portions of your skull lined with mucous membranes. I imagine you could perforate them somehow. It probably would be easier to get through the bony prominence where your smell sensors penetrate through the nostril plate. The sinuses, I don't really think so. I don't think the risks are that terribly high. You're going to have a lot of respiratory problems, most likely. I don't think you'll have significant neurological deficits, but who knows. But I think you'd get more penetration. It's called the cribriform plate. It's where the little smell sensors from your brain go through and connect to your breathing.
That sounds good. Thanks for the correction.
Roy, do you think that this moon dust is worse then let's say fiberglass, you know, the fiberglass people use for insulation in their house. You know, that's a popular thing that people are around. You know, they might crawl around in a crawl space or something like that. Do you think it's about equal, or which would you rather be exposed to? I know it's none, but you know, I mean, that stuff is pretty serious. I've been around that, and it's, you know, I'm surprised I didn't do more damage myself, you know, going near that stuff. But what you know, what would you say is worse? Back to you, Ryan.
This would be purely a guess on my part, but I would not be at all surprised if the nature of the moon dust is more like asbestos than it is fiberglass. Thankfully, very few people have been exposed. Enormous numbers of people had to be exposed to asbestos before mesothelioma was figured out to be part of that. But it seems to have a lot of the similar qualities to asbestos particulate matter. It gets really down deep into the lung alveoli, and it probably acts as an irritant to cause an increase in the turnover of cells. So you just add a little coal tar, smoke, secondhand to firsthand, and you got yourself a real mess.
Yeah, okay, well, if it's anything like asbestos, I could see NASA really being worried about this stuff. Okay, thanks for that. Before I go on, is there any other comments? It's funny, even though I hear the repeated dropping, I'm looking at the S-meter and watching it drop. By the way, the S-meter is 10. There is a difference. Used to be in about maybe a 6 or a 7 last week. Now we're all the way up. Okay, on another topic, we were talking about China earlier. So China is getting pushing the limit. They now have a heavy-duty booster. Rocket, the whole setup. Well, their rockets are called long marches. You know, there was a long march 1, 2, 3. You know, and they worked their way up. They got to the long march 4. And they skipped 5. And they went right to 6 and 7. 7 is a, you know, it's a medium to heavy duty booster rocket setup. But now this other one, they call it long march 5. This is the equivalent to, like, our Delta Heavy, you know, NASA's big rocket. So it could lift almost 3 million pounds of thrust. It has around 3 million pounds of thrust. It could put maybe 30, 40,000 pounds of payload into low Earth orbit, maybe 18 or 20,000 pounds you could bring all the way to the moon. They plan on using this on a regular basis. They launched it back in 2015. It was successful as a test. And then they put a nice satellite on it 2 years later. And it didn't make it to orbit. They had some failures in the engine. You have these turbos that spin at, you know, like 100,000 RPM. And, one broke. And they had to redesign that whole setup for a couple of years, and here we are in 2019. Just the day after Christmas, let's see, 27th, 2 days after Christmas, they launched the Long March 5, and it was successful. They had a satellite on it, put it into geosynchronous orbit. Standby, I didn't let it drop. There we go. Now they pretty much copied a lot of designs from different countries, including our design of the liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket, and that's what they now have All of their rockets in the past have been carcinogenic fuels. They haven't even been using kerosene. They use that unsymmetric dimethylide hydrazine fuel, which is, they've had boosters come down in a, on top of people and kill, kill people directly, and naturally you have this cancerous stuff all over the place. So it's been a problem for China, and that's because most of their launch complexes are inland. They built a special launch complex for this rocket on the water, the China Sea, and they completed that, and they were able to now launch this rocket from that location. And this way the boosters now wind up in the China Sea, set them on a populated area, setting fires and everything. They've had enough of a problem with that. So that now what they've done is they've launched this thing. Since it's been successful, it had 8 engines on the bottom. It had 2 liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, and then the other one, the other 6 engines are all liquid kerosene. So they stepped up to the modern world. And they even put cameras on the top so you can look back at the bottom. And the, you can see the boosters separating. Cameras near the top, you can see the satellite being put into place. And what this does for them, that enables them to go ahead with these further launches that they plan on. They have a mission coming up this year, which they plan on doing a moon sample return mission. They're going to send up Chang-5. It's going to land on the moon, on the near side of the moon. The last flight they actually landed on the dark side of the moon. This one they're going to land on the near side of the moon. They're going to pick up a sample and they're going to send it back to Earth. But they need a larger vehicle to do that. This is the one that they're going to use. They also plan on manned missions with this thing. This thing is now human rated. They built a 300 foot tall gantry launch complex in China, where this new launch complex has been built. And they plan on eventually sending people to the moon. Not only that, they would like to send people to Mars. So this is
the time is 12:04 a.m. 73 and good night from the W2VL repeater. Good morning, the time is 12:04 a.m. This is the W2VL repeater.
Space station, which will eventually have 5 modules attached to it. And this long March 5 rocket will do that heavy work. So, as we're playing around here and doing what we're doing, we're not paying attention to what China's doing in this country. We're going to have China doing sample returns. We could eventually have manned missions to the moon. And they can't make up their mind on, we can't make up our mind on how we're going to actually land future people on the moon and eventually Mars. And China has plans on eventually going to Mars. This summer, they're going to use the same rocket, the Long March 5, they're going to put a orbiter, Mars orbiter, and a Mars rover into this one launch, and they're going to launch it to Mars. This way, next year, 2021, they'll have a rover riding around on Mars. So, they haven't caught up, but, they're doing a good job of catching up between, definitely they're catching up to us. They've, in my opinion, passed the Russians. And although the Russians have more of a, you know, the capability of launching people on a regular basis, you know, Russia has a manned program to go to the moon, but if they do it by 2035, they'll be lucky. So hopefully, we get our act together. You know, we're doing very good with our telescopes. We have the James Webb Space Telescope going up in 2 years. We have our Mars rover, 2020 rover, which is bigger than Curiosity. You know, Curiosity is roughly about 10 foot by 10 foot. And this one's a little bit bigger, around 11 feet by 10 and a half feet. But it's essentially, it looks the same. It's got bigger wheels. And it will be looking for microbial, past signs of microbial life when we get there. So, you know, we're way ahead of the game. We have a nuclear-powered rover. China's rover will probably be, I think I saw solar panels on it, so that will be solar panels. And not to be outdone, the European Space Agency is going to launch at the same time. So we're going to have roughly three, within a month or so, we're going to have three launches going to Mars with three different rovers. United States, Mars 2020 rover. China with their rover. Sort of name, but I forgot the name of it. And you're going to have the European Space Agency with the Rosalind Franklin. They named it after a woman. Scientists will be going up also, and they're all landing in 2021. Old habits die hard. I keep keying up before the repeater drops out. So, okay. I had some information about slow scan TV. I tried to do it once years ago, but it didn't work out. But now they have much better ways of doing it. You could, download these programs, and all you need is a sound card and tie it into any kind of Microsoft computer. Or not. I think you could also use an Apple computer. Could get ready for us. I think it's going to go until the beginning of January 2nd or 3rd.
That or from the ARRL. And
that that would tell you where the ISS is and when it's going to be in your neighborhood. So, I'm not going to do it, but I was thinking if, you know, if anybody wants to do it, they could research it and... International Space Station astronaut. She's been up there since March, so she's broken the record by Peggy Whitson. Peggy Whitson was another astronaut that spent a total of 288 days up there recently, not too long ago. But now she's up to 289 days, and she's got another little over a month left, around 40 some odd days to go before Christina Cook comes back. So she's set the record for that. And, you know, I don't know if they have any other plans for long-term flights. You just had Kelly. He did it almost a year. And now Christine is doing the same thing. That's pretty good. That's pretty much all I have for now. Let me turn it over to Dick, see if he has any comments, questions, or... wants to continue on. Repeated, did pretty good tonight. Turn over to you, Dick. K2RIW, this is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet.
Paul, does China have a International Space Station that's active or going to become active? And is China pursuing putting a Chinese man on the moon? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, well, next year they plan on launching the first section of their next space station. You know, this will be Tiangong 3 or their space station 3. I think it stands for Heavenly Palace. So Tiangong, that's the translation. And the first one was a test that was successful. They sent up two different crews to that, and then brought them back. And then that was the one they eventually lost control of, and eventually just deorbited wherever it felt like it. Luckily, it didn't hit anybody. Tiangong 2 went up. They tested a progress type of vehicle. They set that up and docked with it, and then undocked. They actually refueled it, make sure they could do refueling, and then undocked with that. They had sent a single crew of two people up to that space station. And then they deorbited that one. That was their testing that they needed to do, those two. And now Tiangong 3 will be their permanent space station. And they're not tied into any other countries, so you know, you really can't call it international. It's going to be just their own space station, and they plan on eventually putting five modules or more, but at least five modules to the space station, and leave a crew of three on board, no more than that. Yeah, that's the plan. Let me drop it.
WA2MHL with a name Bob with a comment.
Okay, WA2MHL. Okay, very good, Bob. Go right ahead, and you can see we're delaying every time we key up because we have problems with the repeater. So we're just letting it drop all together. Over to you, Bob.
Yes. My question is about events in space. Is there any possibility for you to make as part of your portion of the meeting each week? One, if you could tell us one visible thing that's happened and where we can see it. Thank you.
Okay, Bob, it sounds like you're talking about visibly seeing, like, the International Space Station go up, or Well, maybe a launch from Wallops Island, Virginia, which happened recently. You know, if that's what you're talking about, yeah, when they come up, we do talk about it. In fact, I took a picture of that and managed to took a picture of a launch from Wallops Island, from Long Island, and we put it on Roy's website, roy.at2gs.com's website. And, you know, we posted that. And as far as visible sites for the International Space Station, we talk about that when they're, you know, when they come up. For the last 3 or 4 months, every now and then I would see a day or two in advance, and I would announce when that sighting would be. Right now, the way orbital mechanics are working, the space station will only be sighted early in the morning, like 5:30 in the morning or something like that. Unless you're an early bird, you're not going to see that. Is that what you're asking? Back to you, Bob. WA2MHLWS2S.
Yes, that's what I had in mind. When there's things happening, even beyond just the International Space Station, even planets, anything interesting, once a month, that you could just tell us this would be a cool thing to do. Thank you very much.
Okay, very good, Bob. And I'm looking now, and I got nothing coming up on the International Space Station detector. So, let's see. Maybe, it looks like we got to wait a bit. I have a good app that's free, by the way, Bob. It's called the ISS Detector. You just download it for free. And you click on it, you tell it, it's going to ask, you need to know what your location is, and you say accept to that, and now you have it. And then you click on it, it always brings up the International Space Station. You can bring up all the other satellites too, like the Hubble and things like that. Some of them they. Okay, I know I timed it out. It's called the International Space Station Detector, ISS Detector. It's a good app for that type of thing. And planetary observations. Yeah, well, okay. We'll try that. But that's, sometimes somebody wants to know where, what's that planet out there? And we always can find that. Nowadays, it's easy to do on the computers. And that's happened quite a bit. Somebody will say, what is that thing in the northeastern sky tonight? And one of us will find it. So, and then there's all the different, you got the Leonard, all the meteorites. When they come up, we try to announce them. The Gemini. Pretty much it. I'm thinking back to what Dick's question was about the astronauts, as they call them, Takanauts from China. And eventually they have a plan on sending people to the moon. Of course, I'm sure that's, probably 10 years away. Back to you, Dick. China's got a ways to go on that. They'll man their space station first, but their ultimate goal, of course, is to get to the moon and to Mars. And they would be very happy if they could beat us to Mars, but I don't see that happening. I think we might make it in 10 years if we're lucky. To Mars. I think maybe Elon Musk might possibly make it to orbit around Mars before that. I don't know about landing. And you've got I guess China will probably be 10 years after that. But, you know, if we stop doing it, we just, you know, fund NASA anymore. Yeah, that could happen as time goes by. You know, we don't own the moon. There was a 1960 agreement between a lot of countries that signed a paper that said that, you know, nobody's going to own the moon. But what about the countries that didn't sign the paper? Are they going to think they own the moon or maybe Mars? Let's see if there's any comments or questions. Or if not, we're going to turn it back to Dick. K2RIW, WS2N. Have any other material, so let me just see if Roy, if you want to add anything. I don't hear any other comments or questions, and I don't really have any other material. I have a couple of long things, but it's pretty hard to do this without timing out. I'm wondering if any, you know, if some of these transmissions I made came out full. Hopefully they will. AC2GS, WS2X.
Yeah, Paul, most of what you said came through. There were just a few little timeouts that I caught on the Echo Link and such. No problem. I was wondering, these agreements were not actually by country. They were by government. So I would assume anything that the Soviet Union signed isn't particularly useful right now. I would imagine that Vladimir would sort of say no one asked him.
That's interesting. I never thought of that. That's true. Yeah. And, I don't think China was on board with that either. I should look that up to find the list of the people that find the Space Accord back in 1960. You know, let's see, 1960, 61. Yeah, we didn't even orbit the Earth yet, and they were signing these agreements. And when we went there, we put a flag on, you know, for an American flag. We didn't put a world flag down. So. And then, you know, we could say we owned it, but suppose they go there, you know, how are you going to protect something like that, you know? Send an army there, send Space Force there. I don't know. These are going to be big problems, especially when they want to investigate life forms, you know, little microbes. They want to find out if they really exist there. Specifically Mars, you know, and, you have different countries showing up. Are they going to go through these sterilization procedures that we go through before you send something to another world? You know, that rover is completely sterilized. Each part, I think, goes to 250 degrees temperature, as hot as they can get it without destroying the electronics. Each individual part and everything, you know, sterile. I wonder if China's going to do the same thing. And then once they land there, and then we land there, you know, a couple of miles away, and we do a test and we find a microbe, you know, are we going to say, oh, that's a Martian, or did that come from China? It's going to open up a big can of worms.
If in doubt, we'll blame the Indians.
You Yeah. And that, you know, holds true for all these other things. You know, they're looking for amino acids on asteroids now. You know, Japan is doing that. So we're doing it, you know, very shortly with Bennu. Osiris Rex mission. So it's always going to be controversial. You know, once they